Today is Wednesday, January 8th. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live. That's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Meta is ending its fact-checking program in favor of a community notes system similar to X, formerly Twitter. The following is an audio of Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg's announcement of a series of major changes to the company's moderation policies and practices, saying that the election felt like a cultural tipping point.
I want to talk about something important today, because it's time to get back to our roots around free expression on Facebook and Instagram. I started building social media to give people a voice. I gave a speech at Georgetown 5 years ago about the importance of protecting free expression, and I still believe this today. But a lot has happened over the last several years. There's been widespread debate about potential harms from online content. Governments and legacy media have pushed to censor more and more. A lot of this is clearly political, but there's also a lot of legitimately bad stuff out there. Drugs, terrorism, child exploitation. These are things that we take very seriously, and I want to make sure that we handle responsibly. So we built a lot of complex systems to moderate content. But the problem with complex systems is they make mistakes. Even if they accidentally censor just 1% of posts, that's millions of people. And we've reached a point where it's just too many mistakes and too much censorship. The recent elections also feel like a cultural tipping point towards once again prioritizing speech. So we're going to get back to our roots and focus on reducing mistakes, simplifying our policies, and restoring free expression on our platforms. More specifically, here's what we're going to do. First, we're going to get rid of fact checkers and replace them with community notes similar to X, starting in the US. After Trump first got elected in 2016, the legacy media wrote nonstop about how misinformation was a threat to democracy. We tried in good faith to address those concerns without becoming the arbiters of truth. But the fact checkers have just been too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they've created, especially in the US. So over the next couple of months, we're going to phase in a more comprehensive community notes system. Second, we're going to simplify our content policies and get rid of a bunch of restrictions on topics like immigration and gender that are just out of touch with mainstream discourse. What started as a movement to be more inclusive has increasingly been used to shut down opinions and shut out people with different ideas, and it's gone too far. So I want to make sure that people can share their beliefs and experiences on our platforms. Third, we're changing how we enforce our policies to reduce the mistakes that account for the vast majority of censorship on our platforms. We used to have filters that scanned for any policy violation. Now, we're going to focus those filters on tackling illegal and high-severity violations. And for lower-severity violations, we're going to rely on someone reporting an issue before we take action. The problem is that the filters make mistakes, and they take down a lot of content that they shouldn't. So by dialing them back, we're going to dramatically reduce the amount of censorship on our platforms. We're also going to tune our content filters to require much higher confidence before taking down content. The reality is that this is a trade-off. It means we're going to catch less bad stuff, but we'll also reduce the number of innocent people's posts and accounts that we accidentally take down. Fourth, we're bringing back civic content. For a while, the community asked to see less politics because it was making people stressed. so we stopped recommending these posts. But it feels like we're in a new era now, and we're starting to get feedback that people want to see this content again. So we're going to start phasing this back into Facebook, Instagram, and Threads while working to keep the communities friendly and positive. Fifth, we're going to move our trust and safety and content moderation teams out of California, and our US-based content review is going to be based in Texas. As we work to promote free expression, I think that it will help us build trust to do this work in places where there is less concern about the bias of our teams. Finally, we're going to work with President Trump to push back on governments around the world that are going after American companies and pushing to censor more. The US has the strongest constitutional protections for free expression in the world. Europe has an ever-increasing number of laws institutionalizing censorship and making it difficult to build anything innovative there. Latin American countries have secret courts that can order companies to quietly take things down. China has censored our apps from even working in the country. The only way that we can push back on this global trend is with the support of the US government. And that's why it's been so difficult over the past 4 years when even the US government has pushed for censorship. By going after us and other American companies, it has emboldened other governments to go even further. But now we have the opportunity to restore free expression, and I am excited to take it. It'll take time to get this right, and these are complex systems. They're never going to be perfect. There's also a lot of illegal stuff that we still need to work very hard to remove. But the bottom line is that after years of having our content moderation work focus primarily on removing content, it is time to focus on reducing mistakes, simplifying our systems, and getting back to our roots about giving people a voice. I'm looking forward to this next chapter. Stay good out there, and more to come soon.
Federal appeals court ruled FCC does not have authority to impose net neutrality rules. An appeals court has overturned the Federal Communications Commission's latest net neutrality rules, paving the way for internet providers to arbitrarily throttle web access for certain customers and services. Net neutrality is the principle that internet service providers, that's the ISPs, must treat all internet communications equally. This means that ISPs should not discriminate against or charge differently by user, content, website, platform, application, or method of communication. Equal treatment means that ISPs are required to provide consistent transfer rates for all data, ensuring that no particular service or content is favored over another. And then the open internet. It's the concept that promotes an open and equal internet for everyone, regardless of the device or applications used, and aims to prevent ISPs from blocking or throttling access to lawful content. And then you have consumer rights. Proponents argue that net neutrality is essential for maintaining a free and open internet where users can access any lawful content without interference from ISPs. The debate around net neutrality is contentious, with arguments focusing on the potential for ISPs to prioritize their own services or those of partners, which could stifle competition and innovation. Critics of net neutrality often argue that it could lead to overregulation of the internet, while supporters emphasize the need for protections to ensure fair access for all users. The ruling is the latest twist in a decade-long battle in Washington over the FCC's ability to regulate telecoms companies. It is also a sign of executive branch agencies' waning authority to interpret the statutes they enforce, thanks to a 2024 Supreme Court decision, Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, and that case overturned the court's previous precedent, known as the Chevron deference, that gave agencies latitude to interpret ambiguous laws. In 2015, the FCC under former President Barack Obama adopted rules that categorize broadband internet providers as telecommunication services and prohibited them from arbitrarily blocking and throttling internet users or giving priority to websites that paid for preferential treatment. Under Donald Trump's first administration in 2018, the FCC rescinded those net neutrality rules. Then in 2024, under Joe Biden, the FCC voted to restore them. A coalition of telecom industry groups sued to block the rules again, leading to the latest ruling by the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. The three-judge panel wrote that for the first 15 years, after Congress passed the Telecommunications Act of 1996, the FCC oversaw the Internet with a light touch and classified Internet service providers as information services, which limited the extent to which the agency could regulate them. That changed in 2015 when the agency interpreted Internet service providers to be telecommunications services, a different category under the 1996 law that allowed for stricter regulations. In an earlier series of cases challenging net neutrality rules, federal courts upheld the FCC's decision to classify Internet service providers as telecommunications services, citing the 1984 Supreme Court case Chevron USA Inc. versus Natural Resources Defense Council Inc., which gave executive branch agencies the authority to interpret ambiguities in laws passed by Congress. But now that the current Supreme Court has overturned the so-called Chevron deference, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the FCC does not have the authority to decide how Internet service providers should be classified. In response to the ruling, FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel called on Congress to take action. USB-C Everything Directive goes into force. Even Apple has complied, as these new rules have forced the company to adopt USB-C on iPhones. The EU's Common Charger Directive went into effect on December the 28th of last year, meaning several categories of devices now need to support charging via the USB-C to be eligible for sale in the region. Consequently, Apple has stopped selling the iPhone 14 and the iPhone SE in the EU. Laptops will also have to allow USB-C charging by April the 28th of this year. If you've been following tech for over a decade or two, you know just how much of a pain charging an electronic device truly was. Electronic devices came in all shapes and sizes, each with its unique and often proprietary charger. You would need a specific charger per electronic device, and that also extended to phones and even smartphones. The world eventually moved on to mini USB, micro USB, and USB-C, but companies like Apple held us back by stubbornly using a lightning port. But thanks to EU legislation, that has now gone into force. We have finally and truly moved on to USB-C everything. The EU's Common Charger Directive is one of the most significant driving forces behind standardizing charging ports not only in the European Union, but also worldwide. Many companies adopted USB-C of their own accord, but the legislation created enough pressure to force holdouts like Apple to concede and adopt USB-C on their devices. The EU's Common Charger Directive was approved by the Council of the EU in October of 2022. Manufacturers were given a transition period to adjust their designs and ensure compliance. On December 28th of last year, the rules went into force for mobile phones, tablets, digital cameras, headphones, headsets, video game consoles, portable speakers, e-readers, keyboards, mice, portable navigation systems, and earbuds sold in the EU. This means that all new devices in the above categories must now support USB-C charging, or else they will not be allowed to be sold in the EU. We've seen the effect of this with companies like Apple no longer being allowed to sell the Lightning-equipped iPhone 14 and iPhone SE. In the EU, prematurely retiring them in the region, thankfully, Apple switched to USB-C with the iPhone 15 series, so newer iPhones are not impacted. Apple's iPhone lineup has shrunk in the EU with USB-C laws going into force. With a common charger, residents in the EU and even globally get the following benefits: massive increase in consumer convenience, as a lot of devices charge with one USB-C charge, regardless of brand. As the charger is decoupled from the devices, more money is saved. However, many companies have absorbed the margin to fight inflation rather than pass on the benefit to consumers. So the net result is a slower increase in prices. Then there's a reduction in e-waste as the rules encourage reusing chargers and discouraging discarding unused chargers, thereby reducing environmental footprint. There's still room to improve. The legislation itself gives laptop makers room until April the 28th of next year to add USB-C as a charging option on laptops sold in the EU. Beyond this, there are several other ways for the EU to achieve further harmonization, like standardizing wall outlets in the region to save us all from the tyranny of travel adapters. Google's Chrome two-factor authentication bypass attacks confirmed. Millions of users at risk. This news item, originally published December 29th, now includes an explanation of how two-factor authentication bypass session cookie compromise works, along with advice from security experts about mitigating the Chrome malicious extension attack. As reported on December the 27th by Reuters, the hackers have compromised several different companies, Chrome's browser extension, in a series of intrusions. That threat actors are using Chrome extensions as an attack methodology is nothing new. But the extent of this latest campaign would appear to show how determined hackers are to steal session cookies and bypass your two-factor authentication protections. Although just one part of what would appear to be a coordinated and wide-reaching campaign to target multiple companies and their Chrome extensions, the total number of users at risk is likely in the millions. The attack against security company Cyberhaven is worth looking at as it both explains the potential dangers of such attacks. With some 400,000 corporate customers alone, and provides an insight into how quickly responding to them is key. Our team has confirmed a malicious cyber attack that occurred on Christmas Eve affecting Cyberhaven's Chrome extension. Howard Ting, CEO of the Data Attack Detection and Incident Response Company, said in a security alert posting, "We want to share the full details of the incident and steps we're taking to protect our customers and mitigate any damage." The Cyberhaven and Chrome extension attack started December the 24th when a phishing threat successfully managed to compromise an employee. Importantly, this included a credentials compromise that enabled the attackers to gain access to the Google Chrome Web Store. The attacker used these credentials to publish a malicious version of the Chrome extension, Ting confirmed. The malicious extension wasn't discovered until late on December the 25th, after which it was removed within 60 minutes. A preliminary investigation into the attack revealed that the initial access vector was by way of a phishing email sent to the registered support email for Cyberhaven's Chrome extension targeting the developers. Cyberhaven has made this email available so as to warn others of what such an initial attack looked like. When the victim clicked on the link, they found themselves within the Google authorization flow for adding a malicious OAuth Google application called Privacy Policy Extension. Cyberhaven said this was hosted on Google.com and part of the standard process for granting access to third-party Google applications that, in this case, inadvertently authorized a malicious application. The employee had Google Advanced Protection enabled and had multi-factor authentication covering his account, Cyberhaven said. No multi-factor authentication prompt was received, and the employee's Google's credentials were not compromised in the attack. A malicious extension, 24.10.4, based on a clean prior version of the official Cyberhaven Chrome extension, was then uploaded to the Chrome Store. Although two-factor authentication remains a vital layer in your credential verification security protection, that doesn't mean it is invulnerable to attack. People often assume incorrectly that only the likes of a two-factor authentication by way of SMS text messages are open to interception and that using a code-generating authentication app is the silver bullet. While apps are a much stronger method of using two-factor authentication for most people, and SMS codes are still better than no two-factor authentication protection, attackers can still bypass this authentication layer. Actually, they don't precisely bypass it, but clone it. An attacker will, by whatever method, redirect the victim to a genuine-looking login page where credentials are entered. When it comes to the two-factor authentication code entry part, by using an attacker-in-the-middle technique, the session cookie that is created when the correct code is entered is captured and stored for later use. This cookie does what it says on the tin, flagging that user session as appropriately authorized. Of course, if an attacker has a copy of that cookie, they can then rerun that session at their leisure and still be seen as the authenticated user. The long story of it is, they caught this problem. We just have to be more careful when we do two-factor authentication that there's no one really looking over your shoulder and copying what you're doing. Doctors say AI is not ready for prime time for patient care. Early testing demonstrates results that could be disastrous for patients. Every so often these days, a study comes out proclaiming that AI is better at diagnosing health problems than a human doctor. These studies are enticing because the healthcare system in America is woefully broken and everyone is searching for solutions. AI presents a potential opportunity to make doctors more efficient by doing a lot of the administrative busy work for them and by doing so, giving them time to see more patients and therefore drive down the ultimate cost of care. There is also the possibility that real-time translation would help non-English speakers gain improved access. For tech companies, the opportunity to serve the healthcare industry could be quite lucrative. In practice, however, it seems that we're not close to replacing doctors with artificial intelligence, or even really augmenting them. The Washington Post spoke with multiple experts, including physicians, to see how early tests of AI are going, and the results were not assuring at all. The problem with tech optimists pushing AI into fields like healthcare is that it's not the same as making consumer software. We already know that Microsoft's Copilot 365 Assistant has bugs. But a small mistake in your PowerPoint presentation is not a big deal. Making mistakes in healthcare can kill people. ChatGPT with 80 others, including both computer scientists and physicians, posing medical questions to ChatGPT and found it offered dangerous responses 20% of the time. 20% problematic responses is not, to me, good enough for actual daily use in the healthcare system. Of course, the proponents will say that AI can augment a doctor's work, not replace them, and you should always check the outputs. And it is true, the Post story interviewed a physician at Stanford who said two-thirds of doctors there with access to a platform record and transcribe patient meetings with AI so they can look them in the eyes during the visit and not be looking down, taking notes. But even there, OpenAI's Whisper technology seems to insert completely made-up information in some recordings. Sharp said Whisper erroneously inserted into a transcript that a patient attributed a cough to exposure to their child, which they never said. Bias from training data has long been a concern amongst AI skeptics, and researchers found in testing that an AI transcription tool assumed a Chinese patient was a computer programmer without the patient ever offering such information. AI could potentially help the healthcare field, but its outputs have to be thoroughly checked, and then how much time a doctor is actually saving. Furthermore, patients have to trust their doctor is actually checking what the AI is producing. Hospital systems will have to put in checks to make sure this is happening, or else complacency might seep in. Fundamentally, generative AI is just a word prediction machine, searching large amounts of data without really understanding the underlying concepts it is returning. It is not intelligent in the same sense as a real human, and it is essentially not able to understand the circumstances unique to each specific individual. It is returning information it has generalized and seen before. Next time you visit your doctor, it might be worth asking if they are using AI in their workflow. AI risk to humanity is 10 to 20% in 27 to 30 years. The godfather of AI cautions about the rapid advancement of AI and its potential to surpass human intelligence. A prominent computer scientist and the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, described AI as a positive development while also cautioning that AI being the cause of human annihilation in a time frame of 27 to 30 years, anywhere between 10 to 20% chance of that happening. This is a sharp deviation from the earlier estimate that he deemed the risk to be only at 10%. In an interview with BBC Radio's Fours Today program, Geoffrey Hinton was asked whether his views on a potential AI apocalypse had changed. He responded by saying, "Not really. 10% to 20%, when asked if the odds had increased, Hinton said, "If anything, you see, we never had to deal with things more intelligent than ourselves before." He added, "And how many examples do you know of a more intelligent thing being controlled by a less intelligent thing? There are very few examples. There's a mother and baby. Evolution put a lot of work into allowing the baby to control the mother, but that's about the only example I know of." Comparing smart machines to humans, Mr. Hinton, Professor Emeritus at the University of Toronto, recently remarked to the press, "We'll be like three-year-olds." He departed from Google the following year in 2023 to become an independent advocate for risks posed by a loophole, AI. He stated that wrongdoers might exploit it. "I don't think it would be where we are now. I thought at some point in the future we would get here," he said. He expressed concern that experts in the field now predict AI systems could become smarter than humans in the next 20 years, saying it's a very scary thought. Hinton called for government intervention as he observed that the development was very, very fast, much faster than I expected, he argued, and that it would be dangerous to count solely on large firms operating on profit incentives to see the safe emergence of AI. "The only thing that can force those big companies to do more research on safety is government regulations," he added. Godfather of AI supports Elon Musk's lawsuit against OpenAI. The youth advocacy group Encode is supporting Musk's lawsuit seeking a preliminary injunction that would stop OpenAI from becoming fully for-profit. An increasingly diverse coalition is forming in opposition to OpenAI's plan to restructure itself into a fully for-profit company. This past Monday, Encode, a youth-led advocacy organization representing young people in dozens of countries, filed an amicus brief in support of Elon Musk's ongoing lawsuit to stop OpenAI's corporate metamorphosis. The filing came with support from one of the biggest names in the field, Nobel and Turing Prizes award winner Geoffrey Hinton, who's often called the godfather of AI. OpenAI was founded as an explicitly safety-focused nonprofit and made a variety of safety-related promises in its charter, Hinton said in a statement released by Encode along with its brief. It received numerous tax and other benefits from its nonprofit status, allowing it to tear all that up when it becomes inconvenient sends a very bad message to other actors in the ecosystem. Hinton recently told the BBC he believes that there is a 10% to 20% chance that AI would lead to human extinction within the next 30 years. Previously, Hinton's been more modest, putting the odds at just 10%. OpenAI is currently structured as a for-profit company controlled by a non-profit board, which places some restrictions on its mission and ability to raise money and compensate investors. The company formally announced its intention to restructure itself as a more traditional for-profit corporation last week. Although the change had been anticipated for some time, and Elon Musk, who was a co-founder of OpenAI, filed his federal lawsuit seeking a preliminary injunction to stop it in November. Encode argues that OpenAI's planned shift from a nonprofit to a Delaware public benefit corporation would undermine specific safety-focused commitments the nonprofit has made to the public. In particular, the brief question whether a for-profit corporation could ever fulfill OpenAI's promise that it will stop competing with and start assisting any value-aligned organization that appears close to building artificial general intelligence before it does. Today, a handful of companies are racing to develop and deploy transformative AI, internalizing the profits, but externalizing the consequences to all of humanity. The president and founder of Encode said in a statement, "The courts must intervene to ensure AI development serves the public interest." For its part, OpenAI has urged the court to reject Musk's lawsuit, arguing that he lacks standing and is seeking to gain an unfair competitive advantage for his own AI startup, xAI. OpenAI also released a trove of emails and other messages from Musk, including several that the company said show Musk advocated for converting the organization from a nonprofit to a for-profit as early as 2017. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and a lot of the different things that are going on in the work world. Mandy reached out to me, and Mandy had an issue it's not so much an issue. She took a position for a company that's a startup, and they talked a lot about stock, and they talked a lot about that they were a startup, and therefore she needed to take lower compensation for that. But as part of the team, she would get these RSUs, which is basically it's restricted stock units. And she was wondering if she made a bad decision. And I will tell you that for the most part, the idea of taking a lower compensation and taking the form of additional compensation in the form of various stock options, restricted stock units, that can be an issue that you're going to have to sort through on yourself. Can you pay your bills? Is this a company that you feel has a good level of a chance of success? Over the course of my career, I have looked at a couple of different startups. I've interviewed with a few of them, and I have gone through this exact math computation. Is it worth working for a company that is they're trying to put together something that is new, unique, novel, and bring that to marketplace? Is that going to be a success for me? Because that's something we have to think about. We have to think about this all the way along through all of the different companies that we go forward and we apply to. We have to think about, where is this company right now? Where is this company going to be in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years? Am I in a place that is going to grow, is going to allow me to grow? Is this something that is going to be good for me? And I can't answer that question for you. I can only answer that for me. I'm going to tell you that there are a whole host of statistics in regards to startups. Even the ones that seemingly look good on the face of it. I mean, there are deeper topics that we have to talk about in regards to what does the leadership look like? What is the overall competition look like, even though you may have a different approach to it? So here's some scary statistics for you. 9 out of 10 startups fail. And this is across the board. This is all of your traditional businesses, like I don't know, like a pizza place or something like that, but also these high-tech startups. And that is something that you have to think about along the way. 40%, only 40% of startups ever become profitable. Only 9% of them survive 10 years. So there's a lot there that you have to think about, that you have to weigh out. So do you want to take a hit in your compensation, your upfront, your dollars per hour, your dollars per year, in the hopes, in this gamble, which is what I think of it as, on all of the different things that are going on? A, the company itself. Their concept, their idea, the leadership in the company, all of these things really start to mount up. One of the different situations I went into, this is 5 years ago, I looked at a company and I interviewed, and I had a very nice interview with a very exciting startup that was looking at an option that was actually proposed many, many years prior. Somebody had a great idea and said we might eventually wind up there. And this company was moving in that direction. But what they wanted to compensate me on a regular basis was very low. And they offered RSUs, these restricted stock units. And the restricted stock units, really all the way along, we started looking at what would they do for me? Well, the company would have to be successful. The company would have to be successful on their own without somebody coming along and somehow diluting my stock options, somehow taking over all of the different things, buying the patents and kicking me to the side. All of these different potential bad things in regards to my job, in regards to my portion of dealing with the company, in regards to all of these different things. And mind you, I was going to be a technical support type person, not one of the people that was owning the patents. And how is that going to play out? And that started to really mount up in my mind. And like, I'm going to take a hit on the upfront, maybe in the future gain quite a bit if the company truly became massively successful. And I did not gamble on that. I looked at it and I said, no, it sounds exciting, but so many of these other things in the world sound exciting. This get rich quick scheme kind of concept, except it wasn't going to be quick. It was going to be 5 years, 10 years down the line. That company actually is succeeding a little bit in that space. They've got something novel and they're going to chase ahead, and they may eventually be somewhere where one of their major, big, huge competitors in the industry will buy them up. But for right now, yeah, they're still a small company and they're still struggling to put together this concept. Mandy, if you're willing to take that risk, if you buy into what they're selling, then maybe that's okay. If not, if you can't be 100% behind all of that, maybe it isn't such a great idea. You have to weigh it out for yourself, though. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Mental health is becoming a top concern for tech professionals. During the pandemic, tech companies embarked on an overzealous hiring spree, driven by the belief that the surge in digital demand would be permanent. In response to challenges such as the Great Resignation, and the rise of quiet quitting, companies scramble to fill positions, offering unprecedented perks, work-from-anywhere arrangements, and generous incentives. Firms like Meta nearly doubled their workforce only to find themselves overstaffed as the world began returning to pre-pandemic norms. Now these companies are urgently correcting course, leading to widespread layoffs. The American workforce may have inadvertently also weakened its position during the Great Resignation and quiet quitting movements, compounded by the ongoing debate and drama over returning to the office. Companies are increasingly turning to talent in Latin America, Eastern Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Southeast Asia, where they can hire highly educated workers at a fraction of the cost. The threat to American jobs is not only from AI, but also from a worldwide workforce that is willing to work hard, adapt, and deliver without the associated complexities. At the end of 2024, approximately 151,484 tech workers were laid off across 542 tech companies, according to data from layoffs.fyi. This significant number reflects the challenges faced by the tech industry during the year, contributing to an unemployment rate of 3.7% for IT workers, which is the highest rate since August of 2020. This increase in unemployment highlights the ongoing volatility in the tech job market, as many professionals grapple with job insecurity and the stress associated with layoffs. The impact of these layoffs is profound, affecting not only the individuals directly involved, but also the overall health of the tech workforce. This indicates that the pressure of unemployment not only affects job performance, but also leads to serious mental health challenges. The stress of unemployment among tech workers is compounded by job insecurity, mental health challenges, and the pressures of a technology-driven work environment. The nature of work in the tech industry often involves high expectations, tight deadlines, and the constant need to adapt to new technologies, which can exacerbate stress levels. Addressing these issues is crucial for fostering a healthier workplace and supporting the well-being of tech professionals during uncertain times. According to the World Health Organization, that's WHO, workplace stress is the top reason for employee absences, with 77% of professionals experiencing burnout. The American Psychological Association reports that 83% of workers in the United States struggle with work-related stress, which affects both their personal and professional lives. The tech industry, often celebrated for innovation and growth, hides a pressing issue affecting its most valuable resources, its employees. Behind the rapid advancements and high productivity, stress and anxiety quietly plague tech professionals, impacting their mental health and overall well-being. In a world driven by tight deadlines, constant innovation, and the pressure to stay ahead of the curve, techies face unique workplace challenges. The consequences are far-reaching, leading to burnout, increased absenteeism, and reduced productivity in organizations that thrive on talent and creativity. It's a wake-up call now for the tech industry. The tech world thrives on innovation, but its workforce is its true backbone. If companies don't address the rising stress and anxiety among their employees, the cost will be high, not just in terms of employee health, but also in creativity, productivity, and retention. Supporting mental health is no longer a luxury. It's a necessity. By creating a balanced and supportive workplace, the tech industry can ensure that its most valuable asset, its people, continue to thrive in this ever-evolving landscape. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now, and Marty, CES was this week, and you're looking, you didn't even go and you're looking tired. What is up with that?
Well, it's remotely contagious now.
Oh, man.
I want to talk about more than just what was there. I also want to talk about what we wish we had seen but didn't.
Okay, sure.
CES, do better next year. robot floor cleaners that occupy a lot less floor space and go a lot longer before nagging us for attention. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes, yeah.
How about affordable outdoor residential security cameras with telephoto lenses because their radio range never brings their images close enough to the edge of the yard?
Sure, yeah.
Or sometimes you can't even see the mailbox from the last place in Wi-Fi where you can put
it. Yeah.
How about goods and services that are one-and-done purchases without commitments to forever payments for subscriptions or updating privileges or support or any other excuse?
You know, we've moved so far away from that, and I'm scared that we're not going to go back to that kind of operation. It's unfortunate.
And there's really no need to feed the greed weed that well.
Yeah.
Online, how about online patient care telehealth services? They can specify, tell you in advance who you're going to see, their credentials, what it's going to cost, and how much of that your insurance will cover.
Yeah, that would be a beautiful thing. Yeah.
Hello. How about a policy from Amazon or the other sellers that mandates a high visibility identification for each item they list of each product's country of origin?
Oh, I like the sound of that one. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, it may be a bargain today, but if there are tariffs tomorrow, it's going to be 160% less of a bargain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also, if you ever need to replace or buy another or purchase things like filters that you have to add to it because they wear out, that replacement stuff, you won't be making a blind decision if you know where it's all from.
Yeah, very true.
In-car.
Yeah.
Because we know CES is now a technology and automotive show, too.
Yes.
In-car, I'd like to see severe weather warnings while you're driving. Okay. I'd like to see in, right? You know, you're about to hit a major storm, pull off in 2 miles and wait 20 minutes and the storm will pass.
Where's the nearest fallout shelter in case of tornadoes and stuff like that?
Yeah, I don't know. Al Sleeth, you're hippy-dippy weatherman.
Sure, okay.
In-car monitoring of carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide and oxygen levels.
You know, I love that idea.
A warning to pull over if it gets out of whack.
You know, we've got all of these different devices in our homes for monitoring that. Why don't we have that for cars?
And the car is smart enough these days to open its own window to exhaust it, not let you start it while it's still bad. You know, all of that. By the way, in Generation 2, we can add a warning for flammable gases, combustibles.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Boom. And it's not even a Tesla with a bad battery.
Well, in all fairness, those are Teslas with good batteries. Well, until they caught fire, in which case it's no batteries.
Wouldn't you like to have a smartphone dock that can drive a bigger monitor when the on-screen type, the typography, gets unreasonably small?
Yes. Yeah.
And
I like
how about,
that.
You know, if you're going to support that bigger screen monitor so you can see what's on the phone screen, throw in a keyboard and a mouse interface and maybe one for a stylus.
Sure.
Right?
I'm digging that, yeah. All right.
How about a robot for raking, compacting, and bagging leaves in the fall?
I would love to see one of those.
And a toaster that can also, take that frozen bagel up top and heat it just enough to let you separate the halves?
Okay. All right, I'm liking that idea.
And a gizmo to tell you which versions of Bluetooth each of your Bluetooth gizmos will support.
That's going to be a difficult one for anybody because so many people don't even understand. They hear Bluetooth and they just figure, okay, it's just going to work versus they don't realize how many variations long. And
all that's and perhaps most significantly, CES needs to establish free transportation, accommodations, meals, and individual preference adult beverages for those attending who are with Computer Talk Radio.
I like that last little plug for us. yeah, CES is, to me, I mentioned this last week. I'm not enthralled with it anymore. It's
CES yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything you've mentioned there, it would be great to see those. I think it would be great to see those at CES. I think it would be wonderful to see any of those outside of CES, just coming forward and saying, hey, we've solved this problem, that problem, rather than us waiting till January to be overwhelmed and disappointed by everything that happens at CES.
Oh, I don't know. I miss the old days of CES when they couldn't do 3D printing and you had to watch the carved and painted balsa wood model of what they are hoping to bring out if enough people seem interested and pre-order them.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, too many prototypes, too many different things that will never see the light of day. Your favorite Eureka Park always comes to mind. And I mean that with all sarcasm.
Eureka Park is Eureka indeed.
As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a presentation, Take Better Notes in Obsidian, which is a knowledge base and note-taking software. Thursday, January the 9th, meeting time, 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, January the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, January the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, the phone number is 347-278-7320. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, January the 23rd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is bcug.com. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, February the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. Tech Ed Connect meets Tuesday, February the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. It is a hybrid meeting. The meeting is at the Scarsdale Public Library at 54 Olmsted Road in Scarsdale, New York, and online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.